This is Block by Block, a community news program from WPPM LP 106.5 FM, where we explore issues affecting the Philadelphia area with news reports from members of the community. I'm Angie Baccia.
And I'm Winter Schneider. In the next half hour, we'll hear stories from our community news reporters about programs to help lower your utility bills, a local band that mixes traditional Japanese drumming with some modern touches, and a retrospective for AIDS Walk Philly, which came to an end this year after nearly four decades.
But first, for the past 5 years, Germantown has been the host to a network of free outdoor pantries called Community Fridges. Neighbors can pick up prepared meals or staple food items 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. As working-class Philadelphians continue to grapple with the impact of the government shutdowns on SNAP benefits, these fridges have provided a bit of relief. But while the fridges have had a big impact, the initiative began with small talk. Block by Block reporter Kalisa Hamid reports it all started with a conversation between a teacher and a coffee shop owner looking to use his third space to support the community.
I had the pleasure of sitting with Miles Orion Butler, who is an artist, activist, and part owner of Many Hands Coffee Roasters and Germantown Espresso Bar, about how the idea for the Germantown Community Fridges was born from a conversation in his coffee shop and helped fill in the gaps for many in Northwest Philadelphia.
It started in 2020. A teacher from Green Street Friends, Jane, came. I was just getting a tea, and we were chatting about what are ways that we could support our community. And community fridges had been, of course, around for a long time, but since the pandemic had started, like, community pantries and community fridges were more prevalent throughout Philadelphia. And so our idea was to initially put the fridge on the back patio of the coffee shop, which didn't end up getting approved by our landlord. But what was cool is we were able to convince the school administration to set up the initial fridge there. And so from there, the teacher community took it on as a project of the school. And we supported by unpacking the fridges. There's like a mural day. We also helped to donate, just because we were across the street, any either non-perishables. Like when we were at Restaurant Depot, we would grab some extra stuff and put it in the pantry or the fridge. And then also cleaning and maintaining in that way. And really, it just started, you know, how so many amazing projects start around the coffee bar, being curious of what are simple ways that we can help people in our community. And then luckily having the school administration be on board, which they weren't initially, but then kind of understood the level of volunteers that were in place that were going to be able to really carry the torch. And while I'm not as involved on the day-to-day organization in terms of working with volunteers and having that level of cohesive schedule, I'm still just super grateful that it was able to happen. And then also now there are at least three fridges that are a part of the Germantown Community Fridge. The original one on Armat Street next to Green Street Friends, and then on High Street next to FUMCOG, the First United Methodist Church of Germantown, and then one on Lena Street, just down the street from the Armat Fridge, but it's sort of in its own little hyper-local community.
I also had a chance to speak with Shan Sims, the communications and outreach coordinator for the Fridges, about their operations, needs for support, and how others may be able to find similar programs in their neighborhoods.
It's been an ebb and flow of food, especially during COVID. Like, it was a really nice beacon for people, not only to have like a safe space outdoors that you could like communicate and stuff, but sharing food was great, especially like a lot of people are getting USDA boxes, but they didn't need everything that was in that box. So instead of that going to waste, they were able to like share it with other neighbors and just kind of be very communal and mutually driven with the food. And so many other businesses were reaching out to give us like pastries or produce and everything. So that really like kickstarted everything. But especially with all the SNAP cuts and all of the funding that nonprofits have lost, I feel like neighbors have been like especially stepping up even more than they have in the past the last couple months. And it's really cool to see.
What started as a coffee shop conversation has blossomed into a five-year-old community initiative, with donations coming from neighbors, local grocery shops, and even local farms. Shan gives a little insight into the neighborly support that keeps these fridges going and how more people can help donate and sustain the effort.
Thankfully, we have a really nice volunteer network, and I personally corral my family into a lot of the debauchery, for lack of a better term. But no, we have a farm share with Germantown Kitchen Garden, which is one of the ways we try to like put money back into our neighborhood and everything too. So we have a volunteer in the summer that goes to her once a week to shop. And that's really fun because then like you can get really like hands-on with that purchase of like, yeah, I want to put carrots in the fridge this week, or like these mushrooms look amazing, like whatever. But then on like a large scale, we work with Caring for Friends, which has a warehouse out in the Northeast, and we have volunteers that pick up from them once a week, and that's like a lot of bulk produce. We work with Grocery Outlet in Mount Airy, and they will just be like, hey, we have stuff that's close to expiring, but it's still good food. So I've gotten Miles and like other community members to kind of drive over there, fill their cars up. My car is just forever filled with fridge donations. But yeah, it's a nice little network of people supporting us. Depending on what people want to donate, we have like a couple different guidelines. If people want to donate like home cooked meals, we ask that it's in nice airtight containers. It's labeled with ingredients. That way, if anybody has dietary restrictions or allergies or just food preferences, they know exactly what's in that piece of food, whether it's a sandwich or a pasta dish or a gluten-free or vegan item, whatever. In terms of like food donations, our fridges and pantries open 24/7, so we can accept food as long as there's space for it. We also take essentials, so like diapers and baby wipes, menstrual supplies, toothbrushes, toothpaste. As long as it's not open or it's not used at all or expired, then we accept it.
You can find out more about Germantown Community Fridge at germantowncommunityfridge.com. And to find some of the many other community fridges and food distribution resources in the region, you can visit sharefoodprogram.org and click on the Find Food menu item.
Meanwhile, folks in West Philly will have an opportunity to get a free meal next Friday when West Philly Produce hosts its 17th annual Black Friday dinner giveaway. West Philly Produce on 62nd Street offers fresh produce, jobs for young people, and community development and education to people living along the West Market Street corridor. I recently spoke with founder and owner Arnette Woodall, who explained why they do a meal giveaway on the day after Thanksgiving every year.
Black Friday is a day that you get to watch TV and see people kicking down doors and fighting over TVs and stuff like that. But it's one of the most stressful days in the underserved community because of the people that suffer through poverty and not having the money to join that crowd. Black Friday is an event that we've been putting on here at West Philly Produce. It's one of our community solutions during this time of the year. We'll be having spaghetti dinners. So we'll be having turkey spaghetti, we'll have a beef spaghetti, and then we'll have a vegetable spaghetti. It's a grab-and-go dinner, so we'll be preparing the dinners. And as people walk up, we just pass them a fork, knife set, and their platter. We'll be starting it at 12, and we'll go from 12 till everything's gone. The goal is to give away 100 dinners. This year, I know we'll get to 100. I can see it happening already. We also encourage people to give us gently used items, clothes, canned goods. You can drop off donations anytime starting after you hear this interview. We just know that the cavalry's not coming. You know, people have been waiting for the cavalry to come for a long time. And we are our own cavalry, and that's why we do this event as well as many more events every year.
West Philly Produce is located at 18 South 62nd Street, just south of Market Street.
As the weather gets colder, many people in the region are preparing for their heating bills to go up. During the government shutdown, it was unclear whether the federal LIHEAP program would be able to help low-income households pay those bills. While that crisis has been averted, there are many other programs designed to make sure Philadelphians don't go cold in the winter months. Germantown United Community Development Corporation hosted a weatherization and utility resource event to help residents find out about resources that are available. Block by Block reporter Amanda Johnson caught up with some of the people who spoke at the event to find out more.
Earlier this month, I went to an event put together by the Germantown United Community Development Corporation to help residents find out more about opportunities that are available. I spoke with Germantown United CDC Residential Service Manager Cherise White about this community event that she put together.
Every 2 to 3 months, I put these informational workshops together. Tonight's was about weatherization and utility assistance resources. So I had the Water Department, PECO, the Department of Revenue, and a few other agencies providing resources about how people can get help with their utility bills. Resources about winterizing your house so we can keep the cold air out and the heat in. So it was a really great turnout. A lot of people had some questions about the different programs, and they were able to talk to each organization on a quick one-to-one, getting information about things they need.
Cherise talked about how helpful the United Way's 211 information hotline is. This hotline helps to connect Philadelphians with the many resources that are available to them in the region.
So if you're looking for rental assistance, if you're looking for utility help, if you're looking for a food bank, there's a break in the sidewalk, you can call 211 or you can text 211 on your phone and it will filter out what you're looking for and give you some really great results.
I spoke with Lauren Felder. She works with PECO, and she shared information about PECO-funded programs that can help people save money on their bills.
PECO has a direct program, which is our CAP program. This is available 365 days of the year. It is not based on the government, and it is not based on what's going around in your community. It's directly from PECO. Our CAP program, which is our customer assistance program, it is income-based.
The income cap is 150% of the federal poverty level, or known as the FPL. That means a family of four with a household income of $48,000 per year or less would qualify for the program, which gives customers an affordable fixed monthly PECO bill so that you never have to pay more than a certain percentage of your total household income on your electric bill. PECO also has a customer assistance program for households who are in a higher income bracket.
PECO has a customer relief program that's running until December 31st. The customer relief program is here to capture those customers that are in the moderate income level. So if you are 150% FPL to 300% FPL, you are eligible for this program. They actually just upped it. It's $750 grant. You do not have to pay it back. It will be directly applied to your PECO account. And a special note, if you're in Philadelphia, you can opt to have $100 go towards your gas component with the gas department and then have the remaining balance go apply to your PECO account.
Although many of the programs at the event were designed to assist low-income Philadelphians, there are other programs available for everyone. The Philadelphia Energy Authority is a city agency that is focused on making energy affordable and sustainable. Emily Lucas is the Director of Residential Programs for the Energy Authority, and she told me about two resources available to Philadelphians.
One is Solarize Philly. Folks who are interested in going solar, they can contact us, and we will connect them with a solar company that we have vetted. And then they get to talk to that solar company and hear about if solar works for them. So that company will come out, they'll take a look at their roof, they'll take a look at the utility bills, and they'll let them know if solar can help them save money. The other program that we have is our water and sewer protection program that's offered through American Water Resources. In Philadelphia, we all live in old houses, and those old houses have old sewer lines and old water lines coming into your house. And that can be a really expensive repair for homeowners if one of those things goes. You've got to dig up the street. You've got to dig up your sidewalk. It can be really expensive, and that can be really intimidating for homeowners and also just very expensive to make those repairs. So the Water and Sewer Protection Program offers an option where you can pay for insurance. It's a small amount every month, but you pay for the insurance, and it protects you in the case of those events.
As the temperature begins to go down, people are also looking for ways to keep the cost of their energy bills down. It is helpful to know that there are some resources to help Philadelphians do just that. For Block by Block, I am Amanda Johnson.
Taiko is a traditional style of Japanese drumming that's growing in popularity in the United States. Casual Fifth is a Philly-based taiko group that recently celebrated its fifth anniversary with a performance at Christchurch Neighborhood House in Old City. Block by Block reporter Campbell Simmons brings us this story.
November 7th and 8th, Casual Fifth held their anniversary performance at the Neighborhood House in Old City. As the show began, you could hear the drumming halfway down the block. In the theater, the sound is ear-splittingly loud. Casual Fifth graciously offers earplugs at the entrance for anyone who needs them. The word taiko simply means drum in Japanese, but in the English-speaking world, it's come to refer to a traditional style of Japanese drumming. Casual Fifth was started by married couple Mac Evans and Alex Pfister, who met playing taiko in college. They continued to study taiko post-grad and eventually founded the group 5 years ago. Over the years, Casual Fifth has grown in popularity, performing at the Chinatown Mid-Autumn Festival, the Philly Art Museum, Porch Fest, and a number of other festivals, fundraisers, and events. Max says the music Casual Fifth is performing taps into a very old tradition, but drummers weren't always front and center.
The drums themselves have been around for like centuries, if not millennia. They are a big part of festivals throughout Japan, or background music for theater. So like Kabuki theater, No theater would always have drums literally just like behind the curtain in the back making sound effects for snow and things like that. It's not until like the 50s and 60s that taiko as we perform it really came about. Drum as the performance.
Alex shared that taiko looks different across Japan, and Casual Fifth showcases the diversity and style of the art form.
The reason sometimes we're playing drums in various configurations, sometimes they're really low to the ground, sometimes they're really high up in the air, sometimes they're at a slant, sometimes they're just kind of flat up and down. All of those different configurations come from different ways that people have developed playing in different regions of Japan over, you know, many, many years.
Taiko in the United States and North America has also been used to empower Asian Americans and has been a tool for Asian American activism. While not all members of Casual Fifth are Japanese or Asian, the group stays connected to various Asian communities and organizing spaces in Philadelphia through their members. They've shown up to drum at protests and events, supporting the No Arena Chinatown movement and Filipino Liberation Organization Anak Bayan. Akira DeSandro, who's been a member of the group since 2021, shared a bit about taiko's significance.
I've read about taiko also being a vehicle to bring more like autonomy and like not aggression, but like kind of power and voice and volume back to like Asian Americans, and not just Japanese Americans, but other Asian Americans kind of gravitated towards taiko to be this really cool Asian American thing, or like just pan-Asian thing to find their voice and find their power too.
Casual Fifth's anniversary performance was energized and physical. The drumming at times bordered on acrobatic, the performers often playing while moving between deep squats or lunges. In the audience, the vibrations reverberate through your bones and resonate in your chest. The group also brought in a mix of influences beyond traditional taiko drumming. Some pieces focused around modern dance, while others blended elements of rock and house music. Alex says taiko brought the members of Casual Fifth together, but several members also play other instruments or have backgrounds in dance. So the group has always found ways to incorporate those skills into their performances.
Kind of the first thing we started thinking about bringing in is modern dance, we were trying to experiment with, can we pair dance with taiko, and does that work, and how do you do that in a way that the taiko doesn't overshadow the dancing if it's happening? And so there's a lot of interesting kind of choreographic choices to try to make to get those things to work together well. And then we've done other collaborations in the past too, with thinking, oh, should we blend some piano in here? And one of our performers also plays the flute and has started playing Japanese flute, which is called fue, which is a traditional pairing between taiko and fue. And so we have a lot of that incorporated. It's more just been sort of an experimentation of what things are maybe not historically paired, but kind of fun and interesting to combine.
For the anniversary show, Casual Fifth hosted members of internationally acclaimed group Sukuroku Daiko. Yutaka Imaizumi and his children, Hikari and Yuki, flew all the way in from Japan to join Casual Fifth in their performances. Sukuroku Daiko was one of the original groups to develop their own style and popularize performance taiko in the 60s. Mac met Yutaka Imaizumi around 10 years ago.
He was doing a performance in New York, and he gave a workshop for the taiko group that I was in at the time. When I moved to Philly, I reached back out to him, and we kind of had a pen pal situation for a while. And then I've just always been in contact with both Imaizumi-sensei and now, like, Hikari and Yuki, his two kids, and other members of Sukuroku Daiko as well. Like, they really, like, brought me into their family, which is so nice. And so, like, their journey here is just like, okay, I need to return the favor. Like, you guys really need to be part of our family. Taiko is and always is about community. That kind of community aspect never really goes away. So really, some of my closest friends over time are from taiko.
Members of the group share that connection to community. Akira says she grew up in a predominantly white suburban area, but Japanese community has always been a part of her life through her family.
Taiko is like another extension of like being able to surround myself in Japanese community and identity. It's very spiritual too. I feel like sometimes it's just like taiko brings so much, like, people say like genki, but like energy, and uplifts people who are playing it and watching it. After we do like this really big piece together, it's like, whoa, we did something.
If you'd like to learn more about Casual Fifth, you can check out their website, casualfifth.com. And a big thank you to Mac, Alex, and Akira for their time and their voices.
For nearly four decades, people gathered on the steps of the Art Museum on the third Sunday in October before walking a 5K loop to raise money and build community support for people living with and dying from HIV and AIDS. Over the last 38 years, AIDS Walk Philly has raised $18 million. Now, Action Wellness, the nonprofit that's responsible for managing the walk, has decided to shift its focus to other forms of advocacy. But while there was no walk this year, members of the community came together for a retrospective celebrating AIDS Walk Philly's legacy. My co-host, Winter Schneider, takes us there.
October's retrospective gave longtime organizers and participants a chance to gather in celebration of a powerful legacy. The love, grief, compassion, and commitment of this community resonated within the walls of the William Way LGBT Community Center. Participants gathered to share stories and revisit this nearly 40-year history together, and for many, the occasion was bittersweet. Mercedes Nesbitt described her deep personal connection to the walk.
I've been doing the walk for 15 years. It's bittersweet to see it go because I'm such in a routine of being there and the community of it and the resources that the funds provide. I know the personal impact of it. My parents were diagnosed with HIV when I was 2 years old. Whenever my mom needed advocacy for her rent or needed help with food, or they had Halloween parties for the kids. I went to Camp Bright Feathers all my childhood because of these resources, so I know the tremendous impact that the funds have. I just wish it was continuing.
The retrospective also featured an exhibit of archival materials curated by William Way archivist John Andrews. I headed to the archive to hear about his process of gathering materials, ranging from when a group of volunteers called From All Walks of Life first planned the walk in 1987 on this site, which was then called Penguin Place.
We pulled materials having to do with the AIDS walk, the long history of it, from lots of different collections. Posters that we had received from Philadelphia Fight, buttons donated by many people over the years, photographs from Au Courant newspaper, and some really interesting things like people would donate some of their materials, LGBT life or what have you, and in there might be a certificate of completion or appreciation for doing the AIDS walk. So really nice to have more personalized things like that from people in the community. Donna Mae Stemmer, a trans woman, very important here in Philadelphia, has passed, but we have some of her photographs, and also in that collection was her certificate of appreciation, which I loved seeing that.
Some of the people attending the retrospective made their own contributions to the archive during the event, donating buttons, t-shirts, and other materials. And many said that it brought back memories. Jay Johnson had this to share.
Seeing the buttons and the articles, and to see how long the walk has been going, and the walk is not going to continue, but still the history's there, and it's something that we'll always remember. And it just really helps me deal with the people in my life that I lost to HIV.
While Action Wellness will no longer organize an annual AIDS walk, the organization plans to continue raising money and awareness in other ways, as Executive Director Mary Evelyn Torres told the audience who gathered for the retrospective.
It is bittersweet that we are here to honor the end of one chapter and the beginning of another in Philadelphia's fight against HIV. It was not just a walk, it was a lifeline. The walk may be ending, but our commitment must not. We must strive for getting to zero, zero new infections, zero deaths, and zero stigma.
Other speakers talked about how much the AIDS walk helped raise awareness among the wider community. Legendary Philadelphia DJ Pierre Robert was MC for the AIDS walk for many years. He passed away unexpectedly in October, just over a week after speaking at the event. At the AIDS walk retrospective, he spoke about the awareness raised by the AIDS walk and how it helped change people's attitudes over time.
In the beginning, we didn't even know. People were afraid to even stand next to someone with AIDS. As we learned more, as the years went by, learned that we didn't have to be afraid of people. And even before that, even if they didn't know, friends started gathering and taking care of their brothers and sisters who were dying rapidly of this illness.
Pierre told attendees that he was inspired by the thousands of people who participated in the walk and who showed up for each other out of compassion. Many longtime participants, like Deborah D'Alessandro, said they walked in honor of those that they had lost to the disease.
I want to call out the name of my friend Hal Water. Water with two T's. He was another volunteer on that early board for From All Walks of Life, and he was my first friend I lost to AIDS. And the stigma that was talked about by the speakers here was very evident in his family. AIDS Walk was incredibly powerful because it was a part of visibility. So this event was very moving for me because I get to say the name of someone who died so young. I think of him every day, but I don't get to say his name very often.
Andrea Lozman Finkelstein, who participated in the walk for 31 years, also walked to honor a loved one.
I do the walk in memory of my brother, Marty Finkelstein. He passed away in January of 1990. But he'd asked me before, get people to help. We need money, we need things, people to be aware of this. And I think if Marty would see what it is today, he would be amazed.
What stays with me, even weeks later, is how the AIDS walk turned that love and that grief into collective action and created a lifeline in dark times. In Pierre Robert's parting words to the group, he focused on compassionate action as a powerful medicine in and of itself.
Take action. Do anything for anyone in any way, and you'll feel better. So thanks. Cheers.
Block by Block is produced by Ivan Felder III, Kalisa Hamid, Helen Horseman Allen, Amanda Johnson, Vanessa Lowe, Samantha Roll, Kennedy Scurry, Campbell Simmons, and us,
Winter Schneider,
and Angie Baccia. Campbell Simmons is our board operator tonight.
Thanks for listening.